Okay, my name is Chuck Ruth. Some of us were together yesterday to talk about geology. And we've already looked at, what's your name?
Micah.
Micah? We looked at Micah's rock collection before the show started. Yesterday we talked about the fact that Earth history is like a book, and geologists worked out the pages of the book in their local area, and we're assembling that book. And then at the end, we showed the paleogeographic maps to kind of show what the book looks like at this point. The book is actually changing as we go along because we get more and more information. And remember, we started by making some observations about rocks and minerals that we could look at, including this one. That's actually an igneous rock, and we said that it was deposited. Did you find somebody? So we made some observations, and we noted that that one was an igneous rock, that is, from a liquid, and the coarse crystals, relatively coarse crystals, were there because it cooled down deep in the earth, and so probably at the middle crustal level. And so by making observations like that, we can piece the history together of Holden area and this part of Washington. And that's actually what we're going to do tomorrow. So we're going to focus in on Holden tomorrow. But before we do that, we needed to talk about geologic time, because geologic time is the principal contribution that geology has made to other sciences. That is, the understanding of how long a time frame we have. And you can imagine that probably as soon as we figured out that we were on Earth, people started wondering how old it was. And there are a variety of myths and stories that grew up around that in almost every culture to explain that. Of course, the Genesis is the one in the Bible, and says it's 7 days. And when the church was so powerful before the Enlightenment and before the Reformation or the Renaissance, that that was the only official word was it was made in 7 days. People started to wonder about that because what they noticed was that the fossils went from more simple at the bottom, simpler at the bottom, and then as you went up through the strata, there would be more and more complex fossils. So this idea that life evolved on Earth became one that was considered. Well, people started running afoul of the Catholic Church, the Church, right away for that, because it seemed to sort of be in conflict with this idea of 7 days. And so it was suppressed for a long time, but now in the Reformation, at the Renaissance, they started to sort of become more secular, and the ideas were based on, they call it the Age of Reason, so reason. And so then they decided that probably it was older than 7 days, but how old? And of course, there's a famous edict by Bishop of Usher, who said that it was, he did all the begots,
Genesis.
And worked it back that it was 6,000 years old on October 6th or something like that. And so that was the official word of the church, that it was 6,000 years old. But that didn't exactly smell right for people, paleontologists, and so they continued to develop this idea of the ancient age of the Earth. And they found fossils in marine fossils up on top of some of the mountains in the Apennines. And they were told that those were sports of nature, that God put those there to just fool you. I don't know why she would want to do that, because it seems like we're foolish enough as it is. But people were not necessarily convinced by that argument, because you look at those fossils and then you look at the living critter and they look just the same. And you're going, what are the odds? You know? So the age of the Earth was still in contention. Geologists thought it was longer than 6,000 years. The church held to that fact. And then finally, based on heat flow, actually, during Victorian time, they started to get heat flow data. And one of the famous physicists at the time in England, Lord Kelvin said, okay, if the Earth formed as a molten mass sometime in the past, and it's now this temperature, we can calculate back, because we know how much heat is escaping, because we have heat flow data. And so that age became 25 million years. And so that made everybody mad. The paleontologists didn't think you could get as much evolution as they saw in the fossil record in 25 million years, because they sort of had an understanding of how quickly things could evolve. The church was mad, because of course 25 million years was way too long for them. And that's where it stood in the late 1800s, until they discovered radioactivity. And so we'll come back to that part of the story in a little while. What I'd like to do, though, now is to look at the geologic time scale, and I think Epson had put, you handed out the time scales. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me see here.
Thank you, sir.
Time is what keeps everything from happening at once. So let's look at the geologic time scale right here. And it's approximately the same that you have here. So, I'm going to have to expand this. And so, A, time is written, although you can't read it on here, you can probably read it on yours. Time is written along the and that's a fairly recent addition in the 20th century, putting absolute ages on that. What they did is, the paleontologists would go out in the field, and they would find layers of rock for which there were fossils. And a big change in our understanding of Earth history was made by a guy who dug canals, actually, in England, a fellow named Smith, William Smith. And you might have seen the book, The Map That Changed the World. Well, what Smith recognized when he was digging canals is that if he got into a layer with certain kind of fossils, he could predict what the next layer was going to be. And all of a sudden it clicked that he had sort of come to this idea of the stratigraphic record. And so that was a big change. And Smith, of course, was a commoner, a ditch digger, essentially, a canal engineer. And so his contribution was not recognized by the Royal Society, because the Royal Society was all the lords and folks, the highborn. And so they can't imagine that a lowly canal builder could add any insight into it. When they did figure it out, people tried to steal the credit for the idea, which is another story. But so they figured out that there were layers for certain fossils that were below or above other layers that had And so they started to develop this geologic time scale, a relative one. And it grew sort of willy-nilly, depending on who studied what units first. Some of the first units were the Carboniferous, so-called Carboniferous, which is here, and will be called maybe Pennsylvania, do they call it Carboniferous on there, Pennsylvanian Permian? Or, I'm sorry, Mississippian Pennsylvanian.
Mississippian
is here?
Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's a division of the Carboniferous, but you can imagine why they studied the Carboniferous first, because it was the Industrial Age and they were looking for coal. And so they called this unit of rocks with certain fossils in them the Carboniferous, because it had all the coal in it. That's the coal majors, and it's the coal majors in Pennsylvania and Mississippi, the Mississippi Valley. And so when the Americans got a hold of it, they changed Carboniferous to Mississippian and Pennsylvanian, because in the U.S., eastern U.S., we can divide those based on fossils into Mississippian and Pennsylvanian. The names, in general, not Carboniferous, but everybody in Europe knew what they meant, but the names are locations, the Mississippi Valley and Pennsylvania, where those rocks were first studied. And so our time scale shows Mississippian and Pennsylvanian. My colleagues in Europe use Carboniferous, but we sort of are at the point where we can interchange and where we can talk. And if I say Pennsylvanian, they know that what I mean is the upper part of the Carboniferous. If I say Mississippi, and they know that that's the lower part. And sometimes I use Carboniferous even here in the States. So they studied these packages of rocks for which there was a distinct fossil assemblage. And what they found was that there was another package of rocks, all kind of related, above them and below them. I've cut the below off, but we can figure that out in a minute. And so they named those after the places where they were first studied. The Permian didn't come along until later, but is from the Perm Basin in Russia. And so we call that the Permian. What that name means is a body of rocks deposited in that time interval. So if we say Pennsylvanian, we know that it's, I can't read that, probably 100 and or 290 to about 210 or something like that, in that neighborhood. The reason I waffle, although I do have a bad memory, the reason I waffle is that depending on what time scale you look at, the ages are a little different, because they originally didn't know the absolute age. They just knew the relative age. It's younger than the Permian fossils here. And so what they did was, they just laid these in relative ages, and then they guessed at the ages at first. Okay, this has, the Pennsylvanian is interesting because it has lots of coal swamps. It also has fossils of centipedes that were this big and 10-foot wide dragonflies, things like that. It has a critter with a sail back on it called the Metriodon, which has teeth that are both like amphibians. I just saw an amphibian out here. There was a toad or something jumping across the thing that I was walking in. Or like lizards. So it has two kinds of teeth, Dimetriodon. And it has a big sail that we think was probably an air conditioner. Probably the blood flowed through there to keep it cool. Because this is a period of time when it's hot and dry, hotter and drier. Okay, so that's the Carboniferous and the Permian. The Triassic, of course, is not a name from an area. But in Western Europe, where most of this work was done by a gentleman geologist, they would get in their carriage and go out and probably had a Squire or something go up the hill and collect the rock. I'm kidding, some of them were actually field guys. But in Western Europe, there is a unit that sits on top of these and below these that has three distinctive formations all over Western Europe. I was trying to remember those last night to see if I could remember. It's the Kuiper, the Muschelkalk, and the... I'll think of the third one. I thought of it last night, but it's gone now. But, so those, anywhere you went in Western Europe, those are the same units. They change a little bit, but not very much. And they have a very distinctive fossil assemblage in them. And so that's where the name Triassic came from. Jurassic... Jurassic Park, right? No,
that's where it came from.
Jura Mountains in western Switzerland and eastern France, and they studied those rocks in the mountains and found a distinctive fossil assemblage that's like that. And so they called it the Jurassic. And once this idea got going, there were just a few people, a handful of geologists, that named a good part of the formations here. Because they were gentlemen geologists, they could travel around to the Perm Basin in Russia and study the rocks and collect fossils, and then go back and talk it over with their friends. And they started a committee on stratigraphic nomenclature, which we still have, that has to judge whether your stratigraphic name is correct. And, well, this side of the critters, let's see. This is funny because Dimitriodon looked something like that guy, but that's not Dimitriodon. So, let's go back, because there's some very interesting stories that went with this. We could take a vote and go, we could decide if we want to go up or down, but we'll go up. Okay, so the Jurassic came from the Jura Mountains, where those rocks fed. And now anywhere in the world, we find those fossils, and we call those rocks Jurassic. And some of the volcanics here in the Cascades, not here in Poland, are Jurassic in age. So those rocks were formed at the same time as the rocks in the Jura Mountains. Cretaceous was named by some French guys, but it's for the Roman or the Latin name for chalk. So guess where that came from? White Cliffs of Dover, right? That's a big chalk, very prominent chalk. It has rocks associated with the chalk. The chalk has microfossils, but they wouldn't have known that at that time. They just knew it was chalk. But the rocks associated with that have a distinctive set of fossils that we thought were, and we're pretty sure it sat on top of the Jurassic. So the Cretaceous is the is from the White Cliffs of Dover. So that's a little bit different than using a location name. And then we got up to the top here, the youngest rocks. And in the very early days in geology, when they were trying to sort out this age and stratigraphic nomenclature, one of the prominent geologists in Italy, it was in the Italian, decided that and this was back before we got to what we just talked about, but the crystalline rocks, the hard rocks, these, of course, they were still talking about the flood, the Great Flood, and so these rocks were called the primary rocks. They were thought to be the oldest ones, on which secondary rocks, and I don't have any samples here because we don't have any sedimentary rocks in this valley, but the sedimentary rocks were deposited. And those were hard sedimentary rocks, like limestones, sandstones that you might see, say, if you went to Grand Canyon. Those in the old nomenclature would be called secondary. And then on top of those were gravels, unconsolidated sedimentary rocks. And those were referred to as tertiary. And then finally, way up at the top, when we show up, it's called quaternary. That was one of the original classification schemes. It didn't work very well. because, you know, these are Jurassic or Cretaceous pluton, so these are not primary by that classification. They're not the oldest rocks, they're actually quite young by comparison. So all that's been jettisoned, except for a long time we used the term tertiary here, and now that's been jettisoned and we use Cenozoic. So if I page down here, the scheme is that we have a part where we had multi-celled life, but fairly compared to us and according to the paleontologists, early life, Paleozoic. And these rocks or these periods all belong to the early life, Paleozoic. That changed upward in the fossil record, and they got more. Let's see here, better. Oh no, I can see it. Critters came out on land, of course, somewhere in the late Paleozoic. And by this time, we started to see lizards, and so this is middle life, Mesozoic. And then Cenozoic, which you just see up at the top of the screen, is sort of more recent life. I'm sorry, my Latin isn't better. I probably could translate that better for you. So the Cenozoic is the part of this that used to be called tertiary, but it sits on top of all this Mesozoic stuff. Now, these names are a little bit difficult, maybe. But what they did to divide up the Cenozoic was they looked at the percentage of clams that are still in alive today. So they looked at the fossil record, and of course the oldest ones, most of those had gone extinct. This one, the Eocene, some of them were still alive. Some of them are still alive here, and more of them are still alive at this point. So that's the way they divided up this ages. For the non-marine section, where they don't have clams, this is the start of the Eohippus, the three-toed horse, and then it becomes bigger and loses all but one of its toes as you go up the higher of the section. So, and these are, by the time you get up here, you have mastodons and things like that. We'll get to that in a minute. So, the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, then the Cenozoic was divided up, well, it's called the Paleogene and the Neogene, just the older part and the younger part, essentially. But it was divided on the number of fossils that form still exists today. And what they did is they just sampled a section of marine rocks that sat on top of the Cretaceous, and they just did the statistics. Sounds kind of crude, but that's what they did. Okay, there are some interesting stories in the lower part, in the Paleozoic, where we started there. Let's see if we get that. Oh, yeah. So here's the Permian from the Perm Basin. And the Devonian, Devonshire, southern England. It's where they first studied those rocks with those kind of fossils in them. And you can go all over the world, and if you find those, most of them are marine. Now they've been correlated to non-marine fossils, but you can go around the world and find Devonian rocks, and you know what age bracket that is. The Devonian is a well-defined age bracket. The Cambrian, Ordovician, and Silurian is quite interesting. Well, lots of interesting stories in this. Like the Carboniferous up there, two great friends, a doctor and an army man, were mapping, and they were fast friends. And they mapped around, and they named the Carboniferous, although they had some arguments. Well, then they were sent to Wales to map. And so they, one started in northern Wales, and one started in southern Wales. And they mapped along there and collected fossils and characterized the rocks. until they got to the middle. And one said, oh, this is all Cambrian. Cambria is the Roman name for Wales. And the other said, this is Silurian. Those same rocks are Silurian. They're not Cambrian, they're Silurian. Because I've been mapping the Silurian. Silurians were another tribe in Wales, an ancient tribe in Wales. So that's why they gave those names. And those two fast friends didn't speak again for the rest of their lives. And actually, it was such a controversy that that it was another generation later before that was solved. And the way they solved was put another package in here. They actually divided it up differently and called it the Ordovician. The Ordovices were another tribe in Wales. So the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian are mapped in Wales, but they are the name of Wales and then some tribes. Now, every beginning geologist student learns a nomogram for Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian. We call it Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, and Permian. And you make up little songs or little rhymes with the first initial of each one of those periods so that when someone tells you Devonian, you know approximately where it is. And the one I learned is Campbell's onion soup devoured my pet parrot. Now, students, as they are, have lots of fairly rude nomograms that don't bear repeating. But nevertheless, that's how they do it. And Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous for the Mesozoic, which is off the screen here, is easy enough that not many nomograms are needed for that. So the basis for this was these are small but multi-celled and hard-shelled critters. By the time you get to the Ordovician, you're starting to see armored fish. Here they are over here. And then by the Silurian, that's the sort of called the age of fishes. That's when fish were, there's no land, plants, or animals yet. That starts about here in the Devonian. And then it really takes off because those plants, they started out with like liverworts and little low-growing things. By the time you got to the Mississippi and Pennsylvania, you had tree ferns probably 60 feet high. And I don't know if they show here any of those giant centipedes, but that attracts kids of all ages. And these big, it was a period of giganticism in those, some of those critters. As you go farther up the time scale, which I intend to do, So there's the Permian coming down to the bottom here. The Triassic is when you start to see more and more lizards. And they get bigger and more dominant. They're not the dominant thing in life until about the middle of the lower part of the Triassic. But then they really get going. By the Jurassic, giganticism has again taken its form. And these are so-called brontosaurus. We don't call them brontosaurus. It turned out that the guy who named brontosaurus, this big long-necked guy, you remember from Jurassic Park, is the only Jurassic dinosaur in the whole movie. But it was actually named earlier by another paleontologist, called a patasaurus. And so in naming fossils, the prior one is always the one that we take. So even though we know and love Brontosaurus, it's gone. The name should have been Apatosaurus. And it's the time that the birds started flying, we think. Well, birds had feathers. and there were dinosaurs with teeth, birds with teeth. Certainly in many places the feathers are preserved in the fossils, so we know that they have feathers. One of the new ideas, I have a friend down in Flagstaff who's a vertebrate paleontologist and sort of by chance specializes in dinosaurs. He thinks now that most of the dinosaurs, especially the raptors, the sauropods, the ones that were predators, had feathers when they were little to keep them warm, and then they lost the feathers later on. That's a new idea. That's sort of, and then in the Cretaceous, then the process continues, and actually the lizards get more and more sophisticated. Here, of course, everybody knows T. Rex. T. Rex turns out probably to be a slug. he chased the Land Rover in Jurassic Park, but he weighed so much that he probably couldn't have turned while he was running. Physically, couldn't have turned. And his connecting tissue for his hips and things. The little arms that he had in front, they're actually a little bit exaggerated in this picture, probably were of no use to him. He probably couldn't even reach his mouth with them, so what are you going to do? He was probably a carrion, and he had this big head and these huge jaws, so he could just crush the critter up. Now, he might have chased something once in a while, but he couldn't have chased it very long. And that's another issue that is probably pretty well demonstrated now, that a lot of these lizards were actually warm-blooded. That they did not have to maintain their temperature from the environment around them. The bone structures look like bone structures in mammals that have warm blood. The pelvic, the size of the pelvis, isn't right for cold-blooded lizards and things like that. So. Probably these guys, and certainly T-Rex was probably warm-blooded. There were some impressive critters, predators during the Cretaceous. Albertosaurus was smaller and probably sleeker. The Velociraptor that you saw in Jurassic Park, all Cretaceous, none of them Jurassic. The Stegosaurus, remember when the paleontologist reaches the sick Stegosaurus and she can't figure out why, so she... Well, I won't believe how she figured, because you remember that. Stegosaurus is a Jurassic dinosaur, but right along that edge of the Jurassic and Cretaceous. They had these ones with frills that are right up here, these big bony plates on the back of their heads that are 10 or 12 feet high. They're the buffalo of the late Cretaceous. And so the world was quite warm at that time, all the way up into the Arctic. There are these duck-billed dinosaurs, which are like the deer of the Cretaceous, I guess. They moved in herds. They were herbivores, so they just sort of moved around like deer do all over. And they lived in the Arctic. We have duck-billed dinosaur fossils in the Arctic. And all of that came to a magnificent end right at the end of the Cretaceous, 65 and a half million years or so ago. And a fella at the Berkeley, the University of California in Berkeley, was working in Italy. He had been working in Italy for a number of years. And he was really interested in finding what we call the KT boundary. Remember I said that the Cenozoic used to be called the Tertiary. So Walter Alvarez was quite interested in finding that boundary in Italy. And so he sort of mapped the fossils and things from both sides. And he got to it at a town called Gubbio. Gubbio is a small hill town in Umbria, in northeastern north of Rome. And it is in a small layer.
He defined it down to a small layer of sedimentary rocks.
And of course, he was, we're going to talk about plate tectonics tomorrow, but he was interested in the magnetic signature of that sample. So they took a core drill and they drilled it. It's a job only a graduate student can love, because you go out and you have to carry water to keep the drill cool, and then you drill these 1-inch diameter core holes, core plugs, in about that long, and then you put those in a very sensitive magnetometer, and if you know the orientation of the core, which you do, if you have the right grad student, you do. And then you put those in a very sensitive magnetometer. You can figure out what the direction of north was at the time. And remember, last night I showed these plates moving around. That's the way we know where they were. And I'll show you that tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit about that, because we need to talk about plate tectonics before we get to Western Washington. Okay, so what Walter found is his father turns out to be a Nobel laureate at Berkeley and in chemistry, and is the one that said physics and chemistry, everything else is butterfly collecting. Well, his son was collecting butterflies in England, I guess you'd say. And he brought, and they did, because you need to know fairly precisely what the magnetic minerals are, you do chemical analysis of those cores when you test them. And what they found was uridium. Uridium is an element that doesn't occur. It's all decayed on Earth. It doesn't decay. It doesn't occur on Earth. And so his dad said, "Walter, my boy," "you have found something very interesting, because you found extraterrestrial uridium at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, right when the dinosaurs went out." And so they proposed, probably 20 years ago now, that some kind of meteorite impact that delivered the uridium also would cause the demise of the dinosaurs. The problem was, we don't know where that hit. And so people have been arguing about that ever since. We now think that it landed in northern Yucatan. And it was about 10 kilometers wide, which meant that if it hit the bottom of the ocean, half of it was still up out of the ocean. So it's a huge collision event. And it spread uridium, and these little sphericals, these little melted spheres, are found all over the world, right at the KT boundary. And some people argue that it's 100,000 years or 10,000 years or something like that, but that's sort of a geeky argument. I think those guys are probably right, that if it didn't cause the end of the dinosaurs, it finished them off. You know, they might have been going out. And but the end of the dinosaurs has been a topic for really creative thinking for a long time. People suggested they died of disease, some kind of virus arose. Gary Larson had them out smoking behind the that was the demise, the end of the dinosaurs. Other people thought the mammals came up and started eating their eggs. And all of those are, except for Gary Larson, all of those have some merit, but they're probably not right for various reasons. And the one that looks like that has the best chance right now, because now you're looking at, you're making observations, putting together those observations into a hypothesis that will include all of those observations. And then, of course, what your detractors, if you didn't like my idea, what you do is you go out and find some piece of evidence that wouldn't fit in that hypothesis, and we'd all have to sort of rethink what we're doing. Well, people are doing that with the Alvarez Crater of Doom. That was his book. What was it?
T-Rex in the Crater of Doom. You think the publicist got a hold of him before that? Well, anyhow, that's the current hypothesis is, I was down in northern Mexico on a field trip a couple years ago, before all the trouble started, and there's a layer that has some of these little sphericals in them. They're not quite, they're smaller than a BB. And they think it's the swash back of the tidal wave from this thing. As you can imagine, it caused quite a lot of... in Denver, Colorado, some of you lived in Denver, the KT boundary, or the KC boundary now, is about halfway up Table Mountain. Triceratops, this guy with the big fur and the three horns on top. Below that layer, mammals above. Nothing but mammals. All mammals, all the time. Yeah.
So, how would the impact wipe out the dinosaurs, but basically it sounds like it left most everything else unseen?
No, it didn't. And actually, dinosaurs are the biggest thing we know about that went extinct, but a lot of things went extinct. But your question is actually a very good one, because there have been other extinction events, one at the end of the Permian, that took out about 80% of the existent form of life on Earth. And so what makes the difference between whether you get through that gate or you don't? And I don't think we know yet. We were talking yesterday about that, and Stephen Gould, who's passed away now, but he would say it's just at the right time and the right place, you know. Maybe they were somehow sheltered from that nuclear winter, lived in the southern hemisphere, who knows what.
I heard Gould say they were small at that point, that they were like red box or toaster size mammals.
Mammals, yeah, and they were like rats, actually. We were like rats.
But there were tinier things that went extinct.
What's that?
There were tinier things that went extinct.
Yeah, that's right. So, who knows?
And it was that it affected the climate very abruptly?
That's right, nuclear winter. And that's what, of course, people are talking about now with the nuclear bombs and stuff. I don't think that's all sorted out yet, why some things pass through and some things don't. But we do know that there have been mass extinctions in the past that took out 88% at the end of the Permian life forms. And then all those environmental niches were filled fairly rapidly, actually. You know, evolution takes place. Maybe you've seen this moth that was white, and then when the Industrial Revolution started, all the soot got on them and they evolved to be black. Why? Because all the white moths got eaten. So it happened. It can happen very rapidly. We were talking yesterday about hominids, humans, actually, almost went extinct. In some places in East Africa, which is probably the only place they were, when the ice age started to change, the climate started to change, some people think they were down to 10,000 individuals. And mostly in East Africa before they started to repopulate and move out. But so humans were right on the edge of extinction because they couldn't adapt to the climate. And we'll get to that when we talk about climate change. Oh, that's right, climate change. If Rick wakes me up, I'm doing two eye-openers.
Tomorrow and Thursday.
One, I'm going to talk about the origin of petroleum. Where does oil come from? And the other is global warming. And those are only 15 or 20 minute talks, so you know we're not going to dive into it but in detail, but at least consider those two topics on two mornings. It doesn't matter to me which order we take them. Figured people would want to know where oil came from. Uh-oh.
A question.
You'll have to leave again. That's the only way it works, man, as far as I can tell.
Are you going to talk about the Precambrian?
I am.
Digital, and the rise of life. And
you bet. in just a few minutes. So this is the pre-human part of the Cenozoic, is when the mammals really got going, and they evolved fairly rapidly. We were talking about three-toed horses and things in the Eocene. Some places in North America are really rich in fossils in this this part of the Cenozoic. Until you get to the Pleistocene, and the Pleistocene is the Ice Age. And the climate changed. It was getting colder and wetter as you moved up that way. We were entering the Ice Age. And by the Pleistocene, which I think is what this says right here, but I can't read it online, that it started about 1.8 million years ago, and the last retreat of the continental glaciers was about 12,000 years ago. And so that, and there were several advances and retreats in the glacial stages during that time. What we do know is that the alpine glaciers, the mountain glaciers in North America, are a little bit older than the continental glaciers. So as the climate changed, the mountains started forming glaciers first, and then pretty soon something happened and this great ice mass came out of northern Canada and covered all the way to the Missouri River. If you think about the Missouri River, is about the southern extent of ice. That's why the Missouri River is there. Someone said they lived in North Dakota, which is flat. It's flat because it's a lake bed from the Pleistocene. And so it's rich soil, but flat is a pancake, just because that's what the bottom of the lake looked like. And then we show up about 200,000 years ago, and probably at least some of the invaders crossed a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. There was an ice-free corridor at times down the east side of the Rocky Mountains, so they may have traveled through there. I think what we're coming to understand now is that some of them came by boat. They weren't stupid. They could just knew that they could get around the ice if they went along there, but they went along the margin. And the reason we think that is that in South America, there are some sites that are 30,000 years old. And so people argue about whether the first Europeans or the first natives showed up in North America 12,000 years. And if they did, they left lots of sites, but they had to run to South America. Because there are 12,000-year-old sites in South America as well. If they showed up 30,000 years ago, they could walk, but they didn't leave very many sites. There's only a few dozen sites. So that debate is also. Now, someone asked about the Precambrian, and that is the period before the Cambrian.
Very good.
Yeah. Well, we're not creative.
Hey, you went to Augustana. Yeah. He's bright.
We're not very creative, but we are descriptive. And so the Precambrian is shown over here in purple on this one, on this time frame. Let me go to this one here. Whoop. I think I've expanded it. Okay. So the Precambrian is all of this before the Cambrian, and that was the original definition. There are small multi-celled critters in it. Most of them don't have any shells until you get to the end of the Precambrian. And there was no land plants at all. There's nothing on the land but preserve it from being eroded, so erosion. It turns out the moon was closer at that time, so the lunar month was probably only half as long as it is now. So it was spinning like a top around, and that affected the climate as well. And so we have not great fossil evidence for lots of this. And in the past, before what I'm going to get to now, this was pretty much lumped as Precambrian. We knew there was some older Precambrian, which we call Archean, and some younger Precambrian, which includes fossils, so it's Proterozoic, the early proto-life. But those are mostly multi-celled, and every so often in the newspaper you see that somebody has found one a little bit older, but they're like thumb, little pinky-sized critters. And but somewhere along the way, they learned to reproduce. Some people think that clade was a big thing because they could sort of use the framework of clade to allow them to reproduce their DNA and exchange it. They didn't exchange much DNA, most of it's asexual reproduction.
What's the mnemonic for Proteros?
I don't know if there is one, actually. Most of the time, I call it Archean and Proterozoic, and that's as far down as I go into those weeds. The rocks at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, some of them are Archean, and the big sedimentary rocks down below the Great Unconformity are Proterozoic in age and have. Some of them are hydrocarbon source rocks, actually. When radioactivity was discovered, it didn't take long before some very clever geologists, chemists, figured out that you could actually determine the absolute ages of those rocks. And so what they looked for at that time were volcanic rocks that were interbedded with the sedimentary rocks, and they would date these volcanic rocks. And so the whole game, and that's why the time scale is still changing, because we're refining those age dates for the fossils. The fossils don't usually tell us exactly what age it is, but the radiometric decay of isotopes does tell us, gives us an indication. So what they do is they sample these minerals, maybe the amphibole in this rock, the black specks, and they crush it up, and what they measure is the amount of argon in the rock. And we know that potassium decays radiometrically to argon, and we know the rate at which it decays. And every so often they will find the decay rate that's used for decay constant for those minerals. But if we know how much daughter product there is, and we know the rate at which it decays, we can back calculate to how much there was originally, and we know that length of time. So what happens is that these minerals are open, that is, the argon can leave until this mineral solidifies. And so that's the closing temperature. It goes through a temperature at which the mineral solidifies, and then from that time on, all the daughter argon is in this mineral. And so, or uranium and lead, same thing. All the lead is in here. And so we know, we actually calculate the date at which this clock was set. And by doing that for literally millions of samples, we have been able to put absolute ages. Let's see what I'm doing here. Absolute ages on this time scale. And so we can tell now that this package of rocks that we knew was Triassic, because it's part of the three, it has same fossils. We have Triassic red beds in the western U.S., and they're beautiful to drive through. We have rocks of these ages, and because there are volcanics here and there around the world, we know fairly precisely, I said fairly precisely, that the Triassic started at 254.0. Well, that's pretty precise if we go one place past a decimal. And then it ends at about 195 or something here. And there are Jurassic age plutons here. Plutons meaning these big bodies that solidified below the surface in this area around here. Question?
So are there different time periods that are grouped in different time spans because like an extinction happened or
that's
something
right.
like that?
Yeah, the sometimes, let's go a little bit down here. Yeah, the different time spans are related to the fossils, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we are trying to find mostly volcanic rocks that give us the age of the change between the Devonian rocks that we know are Devonian and rocks that we know are Carboniferous. And what's happening is, as we get better at determining these ages, these dates, the ages change a little bit. So the absolute ages on different time scales will be a little bit different, depending on who they believe. And the best ones come out of Cambridge now, the ones that, okay, got it. You have a few to decide upon. What are you going to do? Well, geologists, the Cambridge lab is really quite good, and so I think a lot of geologists have decided, okay, you know, I can't figure this out. I'm going with the Cambridge guys. And so their ages, I don't know if their ages are actually on this one, but let's see, are we supposed to be done?
7.
Okay, I have one more slide. And that is, this is the age of the Earth plotted as a football field. Linearly. Okay? And what you. I'm trying to find the right size here.
It was good. That last one.
Here, let's see. Maybe this will work on this guy. Voila.
Yeah, good.
Voila. So. This is a football field. Everybody knows 100 yards long. So let's look at the what we now think. We, of course, about calculate back to the formation of the Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. And what you notice is that the Cambrian doesn't start till here. Right? So all of this before the Cambrian and really the time when there was a microcellular life or some life without lots of hard parts, we now think that probably some of them had hard parts, goes back into the Precambrian, but life didn't start until somewhere back here, this far along. So all of this time, Earth was just seething and eroding, redepositing, metamorphism, igneous rocks, all of that time. We have about 4/5 of the age of the Earth. There's nothing to show for these, a few rocks, but no, it's the underpinnings for the rest of it. Life starts here, maybe with the first jellyfish that have first multicellular organisms back here. And now, this is from the USGS, so this is probably pretty recent, and reflects discoveries in Australia is where some of it comes from, and Namibia is another place where the oldest rocks are exposed. But they're only about this age anyway. So the first reptiles are here. The Paleozoic extinctions that we talked about, 80% of life on Earth goes out about here. We're like at the 7-yard line. We're in the red zone, according to the guys on Monday Night Football. Let's see, the first dinosaurs are here, that's in the Triassic, the Jurassic period, we're at a 4.5-yard line, we can like see the end zone. The first birds, I don't think that's exactly right. That's back in the, yeah, that might be the Jurassic, so that's probably right. And then the Mesozoic extinctions, where the dinosaurs go out, are at the 1.4 yard line. So we can actually sort of see the yard line. We'd hand it to one of those big guys, and they can carry it in from there. The first human ancestor is 200,000 years ago. That's at 1.2 inches from the goal line. And then the first modern human, the ice ages are about the last 0.8 inches. And then the first modern man, 200,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens shows up, is about 0.8 inches from the goal line. You had a question? Okay. Mark Twain put it that that the paint on top of the Eiffel Tower, the thickness of the paint is about 1/8 of an inch. And some people think that the whole purpose of the Eiffel Tower is to hold up that thing. Okay, so that's deep time. We call it deep time. Not sure who coined it, maybe Stephen Gould. But what we mean by deep time is how long this has been going on. And it has revised the way we look at everything, from the universe to certainly to our evolution on Earth. So it's time to go. I will quit there. And tomorrow morning, if it gets me up, we'll talk about whatever the crowd wants to talk about. Given two choices: origin of petroleum, where does the oil and gas come from? And do we have a lot of it or not? Are we going to run out soon? And
check with BP.
BP, it turns out, is a tragedy, but is not significant in that calculation.
Yeah.
What time was it?
7:15.
Oh, man.
Oh,
that's
why.
Yeah, I over 7:15 in the a.m. under lodge chalet number 2.
Is that where it is?
Yes.
I'm glad you said that.
I'll walk you down, Chuck. I have some others of invention.